Blog Talk Radio.
And one that you have an important role to play in bringing about. At the World Transformed, we want to introduce you to what may be the biggest transformation of them all, the one that begins with considering and acting on the almost limitless possibilities that lie before us, and that ends somewhere beyond the reach of the human imagination. So when does this amazing future begin? Well, today is the day. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and I am flying solo this evening here in the virtual studio. My co-host Stephen Gordon has the night off, had an unexpected and unplanned and unwanted, well, I don't know about unwanted, but anyway, an unexpected conflict, can't make it this evening, and I get to run this thing myself, so I'm just going to jump right into it and introduce our two very special guests that we have with us this evening. First off, we've got Are You Serious? Are You is a writer, editor, and well-known digital iconoclast. He was co-publisher of the first popular digital magazine, Mondo 2000, from 1988 to 1993, and co-editor of the popular book Mondo 2000, A User's Guide to the New Edge. He's written about technology and culture for Wired, Rolling Stone, and Boing Boing. He also lectures widely, and he's author of a new book called Transcendence, which we'll be talking about at great length this evening. Are You, welcome back to The World Transformed.
Thanks, Phil. It's good to be here.
Always great to have you with us, and we're also very pleased to welcome for the first time Jay Cornell. He is the former managing editor of H Plus Magazine and senior web developer at Landkamer Partners. Jay, welcome to The World Transformed.
Thanks, Phil. Happy to be here.
Well, it's great to have you both with us, and I'm so excited to be talking about your book. The book is called Transcendence, the Disinformation Encyclopedia of Transhumanism and the Singularity, and I have a lot to say about this book and a lot of questions I want to ask. The thing I was going to remind Stephen of when we first came on, it seems that the last time we had an author on talking about their book, it was just a few weeks ago, that was also an encyclopedia. So my very first question to you guys is, why do an encyclopedia on these subjects? Why not say a history of transhumanism and the singularity or some other approach? What's the thought behind doing an encyclopedia?
Well, I mean, it definitely is not a history of transhumanism and the singularity. That would be a narrative story. This is not quite as much of a challenge, but it's a great way of organizing data and amusing anecdotes and basically telling people what some of the sciences and technologies and organizations and personalities and so forth are involved. One of our reviewers called it a fun cyclopedia, which I think is a lovely name for it, because encyclopedia sounds a little intimidating. You know, it sounds like you go out and buy the Britannica or whatever, which some of us enjoy reading, but generally people like things in shorter, quicker bites. And that's what we've done here. We've done an A to Z with over 90 topics that somehow seem to all in some ways connect and form a way of looking at the world or a way of dealing with the world and the coming world of the future and so forth. So, yeah, I mean, that's basically it. The Mondo 2000 book, A User's Guide to the New Edge, was the same format, but they called it a user's guide rather than an encyclopedia. So that was the book company's choice to call it an encyclopedia.
The great thing about this kind of format is you can just open it anywhere, and you're on an interesting topic, yeah, and you can start reading. There's no reason to try to read it in order. There is no order. It's alphabetical, right? the
yeah, you can leave it on your bathroom stall and pick it up and open it up, and there's a new topic every few pages, which is not
so slowly,
to say that it's shallow necessarily.
No, but it gives you an intro to each of these topics. It's hardly an exhaustive treatment of them, but it gets you started on them. I just want to say, you know, not to take on the other reviewer, but Fun Cyclopedia sounds like something they would try to get you to read as a kid, doesn't it?
Well, they're all big kids out there.
Something kind of dangerous about that term. So let me give, if I gave the whole title, I love this, Transcendence, the Disinformation Encyclopedia of Transhumanism and the Singularity. So, Jay, why a disinformation guide? Are we setting the record straight here, or are we conveying the disinformation? What's going on?
The imprint of the publisher is Disinformation Books, which is sort of a semi-tongue-in-cheek kind of naming that they gave themselves. And so we don't mean to, and they don't mean to imply that our book is filled with disinformation. It's more the Disinformation Books, you know, trademark encyclopedia.
Yeah,
oh,
but it
so
could have been very, it could have
thing,
been very
huh?
liberating for us. We could have made stuff up, but we didn't take advantage of that.
Well, we got to come to that because actually, for someone who is purely a novice, purely a virgin to these subjects, they might well think you were just making some of this stuff up. Would you agree that talk about stranger than fiction? You know, some of the ideas.
In the second edition, I think we should make up one false entry and then sort of challenge people to figure out which one it is.
That's a great idea. Yeah, see if they find it. Are there plans for a second edition? I guess we should come to that later. But you brought it up, so. You guys thinking about more you could add?
Well, we're hoping. We're sort of gathering, you know, corrections and comments from people. And if it sells well, we'll convince the publisher to, you know, do a revised and expanded edition.
This thing about it seeming like fiction to people, I think that people are maybe not all people, but a lot of people are more sophisticated now than they were in 1993 when I toured behind the Mondo 2000 User's Guide to the New Edge, which had some of these same topics in it, like nanotechnology and virtual reality, but it was also introducing the idea of digital culture and the Internet and so forth. And, boy, nobody had a clue. I mean, even like the San Francisco Bay Guardian didn't have anybody they could assign to review the book because nobody knew anything about it. You know, I talked to major newspapers in just about every city that we went to and went on TV, and no idea whatsoever, which was awfully fun because, you could be pretty playful without having to be too detailed. And now people, a lot of people know a lot of stuff. Not everybody, but a lot of people do.
And so then as the authors, you guys have to know some stuff too, right? I mean, it raises the bar all the way around, doesn't it?
Yep.
So, you know, as one of the questions I'm thinking as I read this, I'll come back to the first one, I guess, is kind of how did you guys get together and how did you start working on this project? But before I ask you that, this kind of relates to the science fiction question, are we just making all this up? You know, I read the book pretty much in one sitting, okay? And I consider myself very much a part of the transhumanist community, the singularitarian community. We talk about these topics every week on the show. I've been blogging about it for 10 years, written pretty extensively about it in various places. So when I ask this question, I'm very much including myself in these people. But the question is, are these people just weird or crazy or what? You know, how did a group of people come to be the proponents of all this? You know what I'm saying? I know you guys haven't written the history of that, but thoughts on that. How did these groups come to coalesce? Is it that the ideas attracted them, or were they just the sort of people who would come up with these kinds of ideas? Or, you know, what's ultimately behind the phenomena that you guys have written about in this book?
I think there's social dynamics standpoint. Yeah, I mean, I think there's actual stuff that's happening in the world, And it appeals to a certain type of people, what some people used to call neophiles, people attracted to novelty, attracted to the new, particularly in the geek set, the so-called geek set, the lovers of technology and science, a certain kind of mind, and they were able to find each other. Way back in the 1980s, when Max and Natasha Moore started the Extropians, it wasn't as easy for people to find each other through the internet and so forth. But that there was stuff happening in the Bay Area, and there was stuff happening in Los Angeles, and people found each other. And it was a branch of the counterculture in a lot of ways. So there was this social thing that went on that Mondo 2000 became the center of in the early 90s, and it was this very weird amalgamation of punks and old beatniks and far out gearheads and somebody popping up at a party that we had way back in 1986 and saying, "I can make copies of my data, but I can't make copies of myself, and I want to solve that problem." And in that period of time, that being so novel that everybody was charmed by it. Now half the people who were there probably would hate to hear that, but at that time it was so new that everybody thought, "Oh, we have a nice far out idea to trip out on or whatever." These different kinds of people keep on coming into this sort of transhumanist fold. I think maybe it's a whole new gang in the 21st century. I don't know if it has the same sort of countercultural nexus that it did at that time. And it's also got Google and DARPA and Singularity University being on the hallowed grounds of NASA and all that kind of stuff going on as well.
Sure. Well, let me add something.
Oh, go ahead, Jay. Yeah.
It has an awful lot of roots in the science fiction world. Back in the 20s and 30s, when science fiction was first being articulated, the term science fiction was invented, the first magazines came out, people were corresponding to each other via the letter columns and forming science fiction clubs and getting interested in technocracy and things like this. There were just vast numbers of similarities. They were thinking about, putting brains into robots and traveling into space and doing all sorts of things that, happened to one extent or another in some ways and sometimes didn't, but there was a lot of that same energy, a lot of the same kind of people, and I think a lot of transhumanism came out of that sort of world, the group of people who like to think about technology, who are optimistic about it, and who are a little bit out of the mainstream culture one way or another.
Absolutely. I think it's really interesting when I look at the title, that it's the Encyclopedia of Transhumanism and the Singularity. One of the interesting things about this phenomenon is that it's really hard to get a cohesive label over the top of it, isn't it? There's not a single term. You can call it transhumanism, but if you kind of leave out the singularity, you're leaving things out. If you talk about the singularity, you're kind of potentially leaving some stuff out too. It's got these parts that add up to what it is, the nanotechnology and the life extension enthusiasts and all the various pieces. But there's something very organic about that. And I know in the book you even spend some time talking about the fact that and I remember when this occurred, transhumanism via the was it called the World Transhumanist Society at that time?
I think it was World Transhumanist Association, wasn't it?
Association, thank you.
That.
Yeah, goes through this rebranding to become Humanity Plus, and that just becomes yet another name, right? It doesn't top everything off or become the one name on top of it. It speaks to a very organic phenomenon, doesn't it? That you can't just slap a name on it. And in fact, if you're going to write a book about it, the best thing to do maybe is just to try to list as many of the topics as you can and give some information on it. So how did the two of you get together? How did you decide that this was going to be a project?
Okay, well, I had a pitch for something that was going to be a user's guide to transhumanism and the singularity that I put together with somebody else who wrote for H Plus magazine under the name of Surf Daddy Orca, who unfortunately passed a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And then I was pitching some books. I don't know if Jay's even heard this story himself yet, but I originally pitched a book called Steal the Singularity. And they kind of, the book company said, huh, what is it? Why don't you just tell us what it is? And I had this pitch already in the file, and I said, oh, yeah, okay, I can do that. And I pitched it to them, and Jay had worked with me at H Plus Magazine, and I'd always found him very good to work with, easy to work with, and felt that he could really help with some of the harder science and math, while I could go off on some of the more cultural topics, although I handled some of the science and math myself. So he expressed an interest in doing it, and here we are.
And in fact, you two are, you know, have the top billing here, but you have a number of co-authors throughout the course of the book too. Tell us a little bit about how that works.
Yeah, well, I got permission. I had been the editor of H Plus Magazine from, oh gosh, I think I started messing around with it sometime in 2007, but at least by 2008, and I think through 2010 and maybe a little bit into 2011. And I'd already discussed with Ben Gertzel at H Plus the idea of being able to use some of the content from H Plus Magazine in exactly this format, so I went to him and asked him once again if this would be okay, and then obviously we had to go get individual permissions from anybody from whom we took more than 400 or 500 words, as the law allows. And the content that was there on H Plus in some ways dictated the topics, and then the topics also sent me scouring through H Plus, the magazine, for the materials from those years that would hook up with the stuff that we came up with. So it's a nice balance, and there's a lot of good voices in here, a lot of expertise, a lot of real fun writing, like Hank Pellessier, very fun stuff, brilliant, funny stuff, James Kent. One of the things I like is that, I mean, there are people in here who don't necessarily identify with the movement, you know, transhumanism and so forth. I mean, James Kent, I don't think, when I mentioned the book was out, he said, oh, is transhumanism still around? so you've got, I always like to have a variety of voices. You were talking about that term transhumanism, and when I first got hired on to be editor of H Plus magazine, I was told by people who were running H Plus that they were trying to get rid of the word transhumanism as I was editing the first periodical. And I had gotten a bunch of my old friends from Mondo 2000 to write articles, and none of them were joiners. None of them really said I'm a transhumanist, but they all used terminology like transhuman or posthuman. And I said, you know, these words are already out there amongst people who are, you know, sort of techno-sophisticates and writers and fans, as Jay says, we're fans of science fiction and so forth.
Absolutely. Well, I look at, you've got people now like Zoltan. He's writing, you know, in Psychology Today, and he's over on Huffington Post and explaining what transhumanism is, you know, taking his take on it, turning it into a political movement and so forth. I don't think that term is going anywhere except for becoming more widely known and probably more hotly debated. It was an interesting effort that people had to decide, you know, we want to back away from that and use something else. But I think the cat was already out of the bag by then. Yeah, I just wanted to mention that for folks listening, a lot of familiar names in the book for listeners to this show: Michael Anisimov, Eliezer Yudkowsky, Ben Gertzel, you had mentioned, Surf Daddy, Orca, so many people that we've talked to whose ideas we've talked about over the years, who show up providing kind of the supporting material for the book. What's great is you're reading an introduction. The introductions to these topics are a lot of fun. They're very informative, but they've got a little bit of in the right places, a little bit of attitude, a little bit of snap to them. And then we get to what it's almost kind of like what the experts say. Something that came out of the magazine. Mm-hmm. Although once in a while, you get a little bit of attitude from then as well, and it creates a kind of a conversation about these things. It makes for some really, really fascinating reading. Just a lot of fun reading this book. And one of the things I wanted to point out is that it's a lot of familiar names, and for folks who listen to this, a lot of familiar topics. But I personally learned quite a bit reading this book. One of the things that I thought going into it that would be my experience was that I would be covering completely familiar ground, and there are a lot of surprises in here. New things that I learned and kind of new angles on ideas that I had read about before, but hadn't looked at them from quite that point of view. So it's just terrific reading all the way around. So let me ask you guys this, and I'll let you each answer this. We'll start with Jay on this one. Which topics out of everything that that you touched on in the book, which topics did you enjoy writing about the most? What's the most fun topic in all of transhumanism and the singularity?
Well, I was I had a
and nobody
had
can
a
say
good...
sex bot, because that's going to be my answer. I'm going to say sex bot. Actually, I think speaking of Hank Pelessi here, he had the most fun with that, didn't he? I believe.
Yeah. Hank had a lot of fun on a lot of topics. He's a funny guy.
I had fun writing the introduction, which is sort of a sweeping brief history of techno optimism, because I'm interested in history and how opinions about technology in the future sort of wax and wane over time, depending on, cultural factors that, back in the days of in the Victorian times of, Thomas Edison, there was this big positive feeling about technology, and then World War I happens and everyone gets depressed again. And then in the 20s and 30s, things are roaring along, and then World War II and the atomic bomb happens. And once again, oh my God, the future is going to be a wasteland. And I found that interesting. One particular topic is called simulation theory, the idea that our universe is actually, a simulation in some future kid's third grade project, a very sort of Matrix-like idea that surprisingly has actual sane scientists who think that this might be not just possible, but actually likely. I found that really interesting. And also the question of, if that is true, how would you ever know? And it turns out there are actually some ways that you could possibly figure that out if it were true. I don't know if you want me to spend a minute and a half or something trying to explain them. I can do that.
Give us one or two of those. That would be great. How do you figure out if you're living in a simulation?
Well, if scientists have measured some universal constant, and then it turns out that that constant changes, that could be a sign that somebody is sort of tweaking the simulation. Another aspect is has to do with this wonderfully named thing in physics called lattice quantum chromodynamics.
Lattice QCD.
And so the explanation for that I've been working on mentally to prepare for interviews like this is that, just as your computer screen is simulating visual reality with a grid of pixels, but if you look at it closely enough, it's actually a bunch of little dots that just in your brain blend together into a continuous view. The way that physicists model reality down at the quantum level is to create, in effect, an artificial lattice, which is basically a three-dimensional grid. And so if our reality actually has a lattice underneath it, then a few things might be true. For example, there would be an upper limit on the energy of cosmic rays and a lower limit on the possible size of anything. And cosmic rays would tend to travel along the axes of the lattice preferentially to other directions. And as it turns out, there is an actual upper limit on the energy of cosmic rays. Now, of course, the boring explanation is, well, you know, it's cosmic microwave background radiation, and that's why there's this cutoff. You know, maybe not. Of course, now it could be that this future and or alien race has managed to create a simulation without lattices, or, you know, there's some other thing that we don't know. But I found that idea and simply the sort of mental problem of, if this is true, how would you ever know, to be very fascinating. And as we talk about briefly in some of the quotes in that section of the book, opinions are divided as to this issue, shall we say.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things that really kind of blew my mind was the Seth Arthur Weisberg opinion. One I just didn't expect at all, which is the, it doesn't matter. Why bother asking the question? Who cares? And it's like, okay, look, you can say we're not in a simulation, but if we are, I feel that it matters, okay, even if we'll never know. To me it feels, I don't know, it feels important. I guess the other way we could know would be if they left an Easter egg of some kind, right? If the designers wanted us to figure it out and decided to tell us, then that would be the other.
There are some people who suspect that the Easter egg that they left for us are the tryptamine hallucinogens, and that you can tap into the other dimensions by smoking or swallowing them. I'm not subscribing to this idea, but it's definitely something interesting to experiment.
Go ahead. Wasn't that in the novel Contact by
Absolutely.
Carl Sagan?
Yeah, I was going to say.
Once you calculated the digits of pi out to some impossibly long number, you started to get a coded message at the end.
Yeah, there was a message in there, absolutely. So, you know, we'll explore on multiple channels. We let some people try the hallucinogens. We'll let some people keep calculating pi and see if we don't come up with something eventually. Okay, how about you? What topics did you enjoy writing about the most?
Yeah, I mean, I really kind of like the stuff that seems unlikely to me. I mean, like DARPA being involved in so many far out projects.
Yeah.
I mean, really going for it. Really going for artificial general intelligence. Really going for cryonics. You know, just really going for it. And as someone who sort of grew up and came up through sort of the anti-war counterculture area. And then just find myself totally intrigued by these crazy freaks at DARPA. To me, that's kind of interesting. And in a weirdly similar vein, something like the Mormon Transhumanist Association. Because, I mean, it's most people who are deep inside this culture know that there's a Mormon Transhumanist Association. But most people would probably assume it's a contradiction in terms. But they have... pretty far out philosophy there that Lincoln Cannon explains in the book. I really had a lot of time, a lot of fun, that is, writing about science fiction and its relation to transhumanism and transhumanist TV, film, and games. That was a lot of fun to do, and it kind of jogged my memory in terms of books and films and TV shows that I really enjoyed.
I think it's interesting when you talk about the Mormon transhumanist group, and I've read about them, I've had some interactions with them. To me, that's an example of one of the ideas that wouldn't pass for science fiction. Because it's like, if you hadn't heard of that and somebody told you about it, I mean, your first response is to say, oh, come on, right? The what, right? I mean, the words,
not believable.
Yeah, they don't even seem to blend. It's like you either got the first word wrong or the second. Okay, I'm not sure what you're trying to say, but that can't be right. And it was great getting perspective on that. I felt a pretty respectful treatment of that organization and of DARPA and everyone who gets talked about. No one gets I would say bashed. The book is fair in its treatment of people. Some interesting little sideways commentary here and there that doesn't rise to the level of being super critical. But for example, in fact, I don't think you even say that they are. I think you say that some people might say that IEEE is kind of boring. For example, when I read that, I had to stop and go, yeah, I can see where. I'm not, some people might say that. Okay, that seems fair enough. I think it was that insider perspective on the community that really makes this so much fun. I can imagine a lot of people reading this book and kind of nodding along with an awful lot of it, and maybe in places going, no, you've missed the point completely. Although I didn't have that reaction at any point.
Go
ahead.
Let me just jump in here. I think one of the strengths of the book is that neither of us are starry-eyed true believers and, cult members, and nor are we cynical naysayers who say it's all terrible stuff that shouldn't or it's going to happen, it's not going to happen or shouldn't. And unfortunately, a lot of the writing about transhumanism tends to fall into one of those two camps. And we try to give a sympathetic look to everything, not jump in on one side or the other of any of the feuds, and sometimes raise an eyebrow here and there about some things we might consider a little outrageous, but we're not going to we try not to take sides.
Well, I'll tell you where that comes through very clearly is you talk about the kind of political divide within the singularitarian and transhumanist movement, but I can't tell from reading that where you guys fall in it. And I'm not asking you. I'm saying that you pulled that off. Okay, I read that. And I'm not sure where they fall. So I felt that was very well done because usually people give themselves away one way or another, and I felt that was very well presented. Interesting. I wanted to ask about that. The breakdown you give in there, the survey that you cite, where I think it comes down to it's about three-quarters of the, or no, a little more than half, I think 56%, something like that, fall pretty much on the left progressive side of the spectrum. And then it was a much smaller number who identified themselves as libertarians. It was, I don't know, in the double digits, but not even 25%, I don't think.
It was two to one progressive over libertarian. And then maybe a half that people somewhere in the middle. Of course, this was done 2 or 3 years ago. I think the culture may have changed back. The times they are changing back, as the movie said. I do think that among young people in colleges and so forth, and with Zoltan Istvan being out there as a popular spokesperson who is coming sort of from a Randian perspective, I think people probably from the transhumanist right have been a little bit more aggressive about organizing and getting their ideas out, and so that people who identify with this in the United States would tend to have, particularly when they're young, would tend to have been welcomed in by people who lean towards libertarianism or one of the sort of strange strains that are now coming out that seem to be like a mix of libertarianism and authoritarianism. It's hard to tell. I mean, I don't think anybody's doing the surveys anymore.
And who did that survey that you cite?
That was IEEE, the Boring survey.
So that was the one thing I was wondering is, well, would an IEEE survey tend to skew left, right? I mean, would the readers, owing to the kind of the nature of the powers behind it, would that be a more left-leaning publication? I don't know. I'm just wondering if those numbers were.
That's possible. I think they took it out to all possible places, but I could be wrong about that.
Anyway, it's very interesting to see the demographic shift there and the dynamic shift there. And one of the things I will say about that is that although the divide is as deep as it is in the real world, as it is in the regular culture, that big political divide doesn't seem to matter quite as much inside this community. Once people get talking about the technology and the cool stuff that's going to happen, it seems that the political stuff, it doesn't go completely away. But there's this interesting area of common interest that seems to supersede the divide, at least some of the time. Would you say that's true?
Yeah, I think I start with the exception of people who are really on the hard edge of one side or the other. I think that's true, and people recognize that things are changing and shifting so rapidly, and the situation is so fluid that it might not be a good idea to fall into a hard and rigid category. I think that
no, there are a lot
of
there are an awful lot of people called, you know, somewhat derogatorily social justice warriors who have, you know, moved into science fiction fandom, the atheist community, the gaming community, and, you know, it doesn't take too many people to kick up a big fuss and, you know, demand that things be rearranged according to their ideas. I'm glad it hasn't happened in the transhumanist community particularly, but I wouldn't want to bet that it would never happen.
Right. Well, you can see where there might be a tendency to want it to happen on the part of some. I've seen, you know, putting the political sides to one side, definitely the, if this is a correct term, if there even is such a thing, the skeptic community, I think, would like to have a piece of the, you know, singularitarian / transhumanist community, you know, have kind of their slant hold sway. And there are some other factions as well. Those are some interesting dynamics. But to your point, so far, no one has actually come in and sort of actually taken over. It seems to be organic enough that doesn't happen. Enough new people coming in and people kind of attracted to the core ideas rather than ultimately what are kind of side ideas. I mean, you know, politics is really interesting, but you can be all political without ever thinking about any of this stuff, right?
I mean, I hope so. I mean, that was always one of the great things about the world of science fiction and science fiction fandom, which I was in many years ago and have just sort of been vaguely connected with since then, is that, you know, even back in the late 60s when you had the Vietnam War going on, yeah, there was some feuding, you know, between right-wing fans and left-wing fans a little bit, but it never seemed to get to the point of breaking anything apart or causing great stress. Hopefully nothing like that is going to happen in transhumanism, where people start deciding, okay, this is the official way you have to, you know, talk about the subject or that subject, and if you're not, then, you know, we'll call you names.
I mean, I think that happens
right.
All the time, but then people kind of bounce back from it. You know, and I think there's this broader community or large group of people, not just in the United States, but in the world, who don't want to be told what particular ideology or set of memes to follow. I mean, people rise up to try to put a stamp on it, and I'm in the hey, relax camp when it comes to people saying that we need to have, you know, we need to define the meaning of life for people, as I read in somebody post today in Facebook, and a transhumanist, you know, we need to come together and agree on the meaning of life. And it's like, you know, leave that. Can you leave that up to me? You know.
Yeah, we'll get a lot done after we accomplish that one thing too. By the way, right? Let's just
yeah.
let's devote some cycles to that. I'm sure that'll go well. Let's talk about other topics in the book. I talked about the fact that I was surprised by pleasantly surprised by the fact that I actually learned quite a bit reading the book. How about the two of you? Were there surprises for you as you delved into this material? Were there things you learned as you looked into this or the things that you thought you knew and you came out of it with a somewhat different view about them?
Sure. One thing I found interesting was that in talking about, in researching criticisms of transhumanism, I wasn't terribly surprised to find out that the Pope, not the current one, but one of the more recent ones, finds the idea of the transformation of humans to be, morally and ethically objectionable. But I was very surprised to find out that while Sunni Muslims agree with that, apparently Shiite Muslims do not, and that Iran, at least some years ago, announced that it had a biotechnology program and was going to try to become a leader in this area. So I hadn't realized there was a split in the Muslim view of this.
That is very interesting. The Iranian biotech program is almost another Mormon transhumanist association. That's, just words you don't expect to to be going together. How about you? Are you big surprises or even small surprises that you bumped into along the way?
What really surprised me actually was stuff that came up after we had already completed the first version of the book that we added into the addendum. And the thing that really blew my mind is the Chronix experiment that is happening with the U.S. Army putting 10 wounded soldiers into a kind of a cryonic state. I don't think they're actually bringing them down to the point where they're technically dead and bringing them back to life again. But I think I expressed some skepticism when I wrote the section on cryonics, and when that came up this year, or last year actually, 2014, after we'd completed the book, that kind of really blew my mind. So I think there's a lot of stuff in the addendum section, I think, actually, is the stuff that that kind of blew me away, really.
I was also interested to learn about the Open Worm Project, which is an open source project to model the nematode C. elegans in digital form, entirely in software. It's got about 1,000 cells and a brain of 302 neurons, and they're basically trying to make a digital copy of it that acts like the real thing. So far, I guess it does, but it's sort of got hard-coded instructions. What they hope to get it to the point where they actually have, a digital simulation of an actual living life form that performs naturally the way the natural life form does.
Do they need to create a digital simulation of the environment in order for that to work? Or, what's it going to be doing?
It's only a nematode. It has a pretty limited environment. Like we have to build a Disneyland or anything.
Yeah, and give it some slime, I guess. But it's got to be some digital slime for it to wallow in or whatever they do, I suppose. So what about this question? Some of these ideas, as we talked about earlier, seem to be going kind of mainstream. And some of the ideas still seem pretty out there. When you go through it, it's interesting. RU, as you were talking about, in 1993, the whole idea of digital culture was a wacky, out there idea, and that is as accepted as regular culture these days. I mean, you don't really have to explain the idea to people; they've heard of it. What do you think in the kind of corpus of transhumanism and singularity? What are the ideas that are the most mainstream, or the ones that are going mainstream the most quickly. Where do you see the most rapid movement occurring for the mainstreaming of these ideas?
Well, I think artificial intelligence clearly, and at least the idea of artificial general intelligence has caught the imaginations of a lot of people. I think that we're starting to see, we expect to see, and we will be seeing at least humanoid, uncanny valley type robots over the next few years that we can sort of talk to in a half-assed way. And of course, they're telling us how to drive our cars and that sort of thing. I also think, in terms of longevity, you get news like the idea that young blood can be used to rejuvenate the elderly in mainstream publications, which is profoundly weird and spooky.
Kind of unsettling, don't you think?
Unsettling, but there's a lot of stuff about longevity and hyperlongevity out there. I think in the mainstream,
yep.
Nanotechnology is suddenly coming on strong with the experiment that's taking place in Israel. Where they're using DNA nanobites to fight cancer, or at least they're trying to. So some kind of, we're beginning to approach an area where those who refuse to talk about the Drexlerian concepts of nanotechnology, of molecular machines that are actually a functional, productive technology, and that we can send nanobots into the body to cure disease. These people are going to have to be on the defensive, I think, at some point soon. So I think there's a lot of that kind of stuff being talked about. The 3D printing and organs, that sort of stuff is really coming into its own. Body parts, external body parts, cyborg type stuff. The idea that maybe you can have legs that are not just as good as the ones that you lost, but that are better. That seems to be coming into the discourse. I think that these are the things that people are really going to be talking about by the end of this century, and I'm beginning to see some movement there. Also psychedelic drugs are coming back as an enhancer. It's becoming very open. CNN has been running a show called Sex and Drugs in Silicon Valley, and they've got a guy on there. I can't think of his name, but a fairly well-known sort of mainstream journalist saying that all the most successful people in Silicon Valley are using hallucinogens, which is something I used to like to say in the 90s, and I thought that had stopped, but apparently I'm now out of the loop or something, and this sort of thing is still going
not
on.
Not the right parties anymore.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jay, yeah.
I was going to say that some of the things that I think are coming along, obviously, really quickly are robotics. They're making really big strides in those in just the last few years. Google has bought a company that builds robots. Was that Boston Dynamics, I think it was called?
Yep.
And also, obviously quadcopter drones are everywhere and in the news these days. I saw the big sign outside the stadium where the Super Bowl will be. It says, no drone zone, Don't fly your drones over the Super Bowl when we play, please.
Amazing. These things they almost sneak up on you, and then suddenly they are so prevalent. I think if 5 years ago, maybe 5-6 years ago, if you had told me every high school would have a 3D printer and a club of kids, trying to make stuff with a 3D printer, I would have thought, well, that's just insane. And yet here we are. We've seen, in the course of this show, we've seen things that we've predicted that are now like kind of every day, all within less than 10-year time frame. It's amazing how fast, not only how fast things come along, but how fast people get used to an idea. When you think how outrageous the idea of a self-driving car was not that long ago, and now The public is sort of getting up to speed with it, but the car makers, they're convinced, right? I mean, they've all got them on their plans. They're all moving ahead with building self-driving cars. It's interesting to see the very strange quickly becoming the mainstream. But it raises the other question, which is, what is still out there, right? What ideas are still, you know, as they say that we'll have, what does it say, nuclear fusion power is 30 years away, and it has been for the last 50 years, yeah.
Right.
Same kind of idea. Which ideas are going to be out there for a long time, do you think? Not going to be mainstream anytime soon.
Well, one that I think is far more difficult than some people think, and possibly even impossible on a certain level, is mind uploading. That was also one that I had a good time researching, because, you know, it's a very the idea has been around for a long time. The idea that you have a sufficiently powerful computer, and it's one way or another reads your mind or transfers the entire contents of your brain to the computer, and then, ta-da, you're alive forever in the computer thinking 10 million times faster than you normally would. There are an awful lot of not just technical but sort of philosophical problems with that we talk about in the book that are actually quite interesting. I mean, for example, let's say you are on your deathbed, they've developed this technology, you know, they put the electrodes on your head or whatever, they transfer your brain to a computer, there you go, just before you die, and then you die.
Right.
Okay, now when this consciousness wakes up in the computer, is it actually you, or is it a copy of you? I mean, as it communicates with people and says, oh boy, thanks for doing that because now I'm alive, in its internal world, it may feel like it's alive, but in the internal world of old-fashioned meet you who just died, I think you would still be dead. It's just there's a copy of you who's living in the computer, which of course is still pretty cool, but it's not quite what we're hoping for, is it? You know, we want to live. We want a copy of ourselves to live.
Exactly. To him, okay, this is one that comes up sometimes on the show. Steve and I, we've thought long and hard about this. The way I see it is, the copy wakes up, and he's me, as far as he's concerned, and he's made it. And he's like, yes, all right, I'm going to live forever now. I'm the digital copy. I win. But from his perspective, he is me, because he's got all my memories. You know, assuming that the copy thing actually works, assuming that the process actually works, he is me. But from the only perspective that matters to me, which is me, you know, that's not me, right? So I understand the objection completely. And I think there are problems around that, and probably just around consciousness in general, that will be a long time being solved. Like what the heck it is, for example. That might...
Yes, and also I think around the concept of sanity or mental health. I mean, mm-hmm. we all know how, you know, sanity and insanity is kind of a gradient, and some people are just a little strange, some people are a lot strange, some people are definitely certifiably nuts. And that can be caused by, you know, relatively slight changes in brain chemistry, in life experiences, and so on. Well, if your brain is transferred to a computer and suddenly you're thinking 10 million faster, you know, it seems like there's a lot of possibility for things to be slightly off one way or another.
Right.
Only because if you are thinking 10 million times faster, and I'm talking to you, then, my God, doesn't that mean that sort of one of your words shows up for every week of my subjective time? I mean,
right.
Could I even speak to you? Wouldn't I get bored or go crazy? So I think there is human psychology is still of only partly understood thing, and so duplicating it in silicon form I think is going to be much more difficult than some people think.
It's a big one. How about you? Are you other ideas that will prove a little more challenging?
I'm with Jay on this actually, but I think one interesting cultural comment is that if you go look around on the net, you will find a lot of people who think that transhumanism, singularity, all of it is all about mind uploading. I suppose maybe it's that movie Transcendence, speaking of the name of the book. There are a number of films and science fiction stories and so forth, but there's this idea that this is the fundamental idea of transhumanism or the singularity that exists out there. And I think it's, of all the topics in our book, it's probably the only one that isn't at least somewhat grounded in very distinct possibility. There are broad subjects like consciousness, but in terms of practical suggestions of things that we might do, like cyborgization and having an exoskeleton, using genomics for targeting disease, all those things I think are grounded in something that we'll get to deal with probably during the next 20, 30, 40 years. And the mind uploading is the one thing that's sort of way out there. But certainly there are some people who swear by it, who think that it's coming up possibly in their lifetimes.
Well, definitely there's a school of thought that believes it's inevitable, and maybe it is. I always say in the introduction that the future will be here sooner than we think, so, we'll see. I was surprised by self-driving cars. I'll be very surprised if this one shows up anytime soon, but again, I've been surprised by force. So with just a couple of minutes left, first off, we talked about the second edition of this. Is this something that you think will have an ongoing life? Will there be further editions of this book?
I think we hope so. I mean, if the book does well, so go out and buy yourself some copies so we can build on this.
Just bought one copy, it will happen.
All right. Makes a great gift, listeners, so think about that. If the second or third or any future edition were coming out, we'll end on this. What topic would you like to be able to include that you weren't able to this time out, because it's not a thing yet, but you'd like it to be a thing that would be included?
Jay, do you have one?
Well, I it's not exactly a topic, but when I was writing my pocket history of techno-optimism in the introduction and sweeping along, and I managed to sweep through the 1960s without mentioning Buckminster Fuller. I don't know how I managed him. I was a fan. I heard him speak live. I read his book.
Oh, wow.
How I possibly have forgotten him, I don't know. But once the book was published, I realized that and just did a gigantic facepalm.
I started to write about a section about Eliezer Yudkowsky and started to talk about Less Wrong, and then I kind of tossed it. But I think in another edition, I would try to explain a little bit about what that is about. If Rachel Hayworth continues her Extreme Futurist Festival, then I would like to include that in another edition. There are a number of things culturally. In terms of the science and technology, I think we hit all the right notes, but stuff comes up. I mean, that's the great thing, is the stuff that comes out of left field between now and our next opportunity to write it up.
Well, I look forward to any future edition, any future additions that you would want to make to the book, with one exception. I was very honored to see that you guys gave me the last word on the Rapture of the Nerds, and I hope I hope I continue to hold that coveted position. Well, listen, gentlemen, what a pleasure. The time has absolutely flown by. Thank you both for being with us, and best of luck to you on the book.
Thank you.
Thank you. We do have a website, transcendencethebook.net, where you can connect with us.
Oh, and we'll be in San Francisco tomorrow night.
Okay, I'll tell you what, I'll put a link to your site up on the show notes and make sure everyone gets to see that. This would be the time normally when I would ask Stephen what the music is. Stephen isn't here, but he's told me that the music is Kaleidoscope by Shockbox. We'll be back again next week with an all-new show. Thanks again to our guests, and until next time, live to see it.
Don't be a ghost.